Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
I'm Andrew Ingram. I'm an alcoholic. And I've been sober since October 26th of 1997. For that, I'm very grateful. Got my two coffees. I want to thank Leslie for asking me to speak, wherever you are. She told me who her four finalists were for this meeting, and I wasn't on the list. So she must have had some no-shows, and here I am. I want to thank the committee for my blanket. Wasn't sure what it was, but I was told it's a blanket, so I guess all the speakers get one. Looks more like a sleeping bag. There we go. Pretty nice. You won't need it this morning. She's a little claustrophobic. I don't know if you know this, but she was stuck in an elevator for an hour last night. So that's dedication. Here she is this morning, ready to go, you know? Just mildly traumatized. What else? That's about it. What Bob said. You know how speakers always say, there was the talk I gave before the meeting in the shower, and then, you know, whatever. Then the talk I gave, and then the one I gave when I went home that night, but I just, for some reason, I had that George Michael song, I Want Your Sex, in my head. So I was like singing that in the shower this morning. It was like, then I thought about it. I'm like, what? Where did this song pop into my head from? I don't know. I must have had some good dreams about my wife last night. I don't know. But good to be here and be sober. It's I don't really talk to other humans normally before 10 a.m. So this is just, this whole thing is a bad idea. They have me up here. But here we go. I'm an alcoholic. It looks like there's a lot of us out here today. My alcoholism started, you know, it started right off the bat, and it hit hard, and it was young and fully alcoholic at a very young age, and I was lucky to get sober at a fairly young age. So I'll tell a little bit about how that came to be. You know, I was, I think I had a pretty good childhood. I seemed like I had a lot of fun. But when I hit junior high school, we'd moved to a new area. And I don't think that I was really you could ask my parents maybe. I don't know. I didn't think I was an overly sensitive kid. But when we moved and it was a new school and hit puberty and all that stuff, all those things happened. And basically what that meant to my pre-alcoholic body was I need a drink. I don't know anybody. I'm all of a sudden extremely self-conscious, which I've never been before, and just having difficulty, you know, not thinking about me. And, you know, I've heard it said that it seemed like everybody showed up an hour before school and talked about who was going to be friends and who was going to say what and who was going to do what. And, you know, and I'd get there and I'd be on the outside looking in, and I didn't have any real friends for a while. And so, that's all I can really remember before I took that first drink. You know, I started to get a couple buddies and started to adjust, but I also started to really act out a lot. I got in a lot of fights. I got expelled from school a lot, or suspended from school, I should say, not expelled, and just kind of a troublemaker, you know. And I got a couple troublemaker buddies, and we found somebody to buy us 3 40-ouncers of Old English 800, which I didn't know about so much, other than the rap music that my suburbanite, white-breaded person was listening to. I don't know why, but something about that, you know, gangster L.A. Compton rap just kind of hit home for me, and I was digging it. So I was listening to that, a lot of Eazy-E and, you know, Ice Cube and N.W.A. and Ice-T and, you know, all those guys. And they talked about this Old English 800 a lot, and so I had to get me some, you know what I mean? And We found this person, and there's three of us. We went to this park in Eugene, Oregon, called Bond Lane Park, and it was right around the corner from the house. And it was at night. It was like 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock. It was dark, and we had our 40s. And, man, that was some horrible-tasting stuff. It really was bad. But once you got past the first couple good chugs, it started to taste better. And when I got down to the O and old E, when I got about halfway done with that thing, it changed my life. It rocked my world. It changed me forever. It was, you know, I'd realized that, my parents had told me, basically, that I was going to be an alcoholic. Okay? I mean, I knew this was coming. They had talked to me about, you know, Uncle Crackhead and, you know, Grandpa Alky and so-and-so and so-and-so. And they'd kind of called it, you know, at a young age, and they'd told me about it. They told me some other weird stuff, too. But that was the one I remember the most. And so, I drank that, and it changed me. It changed, like Clancy says, my perception in a good way. It gave me that confidence. It gave me that boost. It gave me an overconfidence. It made me feel like I could do anything, and I did basically, you know, live out all those things that came to pass over the next few years. But I finished that thing and I felt great. I mean, I just felt like a world-class boxer. I felt like a lover beyond lovers. I mean, just like the man. And I could run fast, and I could dance, you know, I could do, and I was with a couple dudes in a dark park drinking 40s, but I mean, I just knew these things, and it just felt so good. And then my buddy, Ron, he drank his about halfway down, and he just projectile vomited it right back out, and then finished it. Yeah. He's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today, sober, like 6 or 7 years now. And then the other guy, he drank half of his and put the cap on it. Something wrong with him. There's always been something wrong with that guy. Always. I went to his wedding in sobriety, and he's doing cocaine, and I thought, oh, man, you know, finally going to get the potential this guy has out of him. And, you know, the next day he's like, he saved it for the following New Year's. Seriously? I mean, I didn't even think that was possible. But anyway, that was my experience. I came home, I stumbled in the front door, and no, I knew I was going to do it again, and I did it again, and I did it a lot, and I've always been very good at getting alcohol. I've always been very good at procuring it for me and my friends, and I'm always the type of person who gets people to go do things they don't really want to do in the first place, and, you know, consequently, I have three tickets for inciting a riot. It sort of seemed so harmless in the beginning. But anyway, so I got a fake ID, and I went down. I found an Asian liquor store, and, you know, they wanted me to fill out some paperwork attesting that I was 21, which I was happy to do, and started buying alcohol for the whole school, basically, and that would drink anyway, you know, which was quite a few people, actually, thinking back on it, drank. And then I started stealing to get money, and I had a paper out, but it just wasn't really enough to cover my alcohol expenses. So I would, steal car stereos, things like that. And I ended up spending every weekend my freshman year of high school in juvie, Skipworth Juvenile Detention Center, which learned a lot in there, actually, on the weekends. Check in Friday, come out Sunday, go to school during the week, play football, play baseball, play basketball, whatever. Go back to juvie on the weekends. It was just, you know, it seemed like a horrible consequence, but to me it just seemed like, you know, just another step in the process of me becoming a full-blown drinker, which was kind of all I really wanted to do. And I know high school was good. I drank through high school. I got arrested a number of different times in high school for different things and went back to juvie a number of times, but I never got expelled from high school. Somehow I managed to stay involved in sports and get good enough grades to continue to play sports, which I loved, football especially. And, I was eventually able to graduate. My senior year, I had a little mishap. I had a number of mishaps, but the one I'd share about a lot was when the summer before my senior year, I was getting ready to play football. We were getting ready to start daily doubles, and I went and I stayed the night with my friend Troy out in Coburg. If any of you know where that is, nobody? Oh, wow, one. Yeah, good, two. The Bowen family, that probably tells you everything you need to know right there. And went out there, and his dad is like full-blown alcoholic. I mean, just bad, distended liver. And, you know, this guy, he was an equipment operator, and it was, you know, just drink and puke and drink and puke until it would stay down. And, you know, I didn't really like that so much. I didn't think that would be like me, though. You know, it was one of those deals. And anyway, he had a bunch of half gallons of Canadian Mist, and Troy and I got up and decided to have one for breakfast, and we were pretty much done with it about 11 o'clock in the morning. And we called our friend Eric because we decided we wanted to go ride horses, and Eric, he was willing to come get us. He knew we were just blitzed, and drove over and picked us up and took us to out west 18th in Eugene to go. This where these horses were we were going to ride. But we were hungry, you know. You know how you get hungry after drinking a half gallon of Canadian Mist for breakfast? You got to get some food in your belly. And we got some chicken, and we ate the chicken on the way over there. And we got there to this farm, and there was, I saw the horses, and I thought, this is great. You know, and I'd never ridden horses before. It was just one of those things. It just seemed like a good idea at the time. And, you know, you're drunk. Let's go ride horses. All right. And so we're there. But then there was this tiger that was in this cage. And this old Bengal circus tiger walking back and forth staring at us. And I just thought, wow, I got it. That is, you know, danger. I ran right over there to see it. And put my hand up to the cage, and it was licking my hand, and it had, you know, it was like, you know, 30 grit sandpaper just licking my hand. And I thought, this is a sweet tiger, and, you know, that's why it's a pet. Obviously, it's a really nice, tame tiger. And so I just stuck my hand in the fence to pet it, you know, I just, whatever. And it just grabbed my thumb and tried to drag me into the cage for all it was worth, man. It was pulling me in, and my arm was in there, and my buddy thought it had taken my whole hand because its lips were halfway up my forearm, and he was scared to death. Well, I wasn't because I was so drunk, but he was scared to death, and I was pulling as hard as I could. I had my feet up on the fence, and he was ran over there, and he was punching it in the nose as hard as he could, and, you know, fortunately, it just got my thumb, so it just kind of ripped the end of my thumb off, and I was able to fly backwards, and, you know, the people that lived there, why they weren't at work on a weekday, I have no idea, but they were home, and they weren't pleased. They were not pleased. They were very upset, and then I was upset at them, you know? It's like, it's your tiger that bit me, you know? What are you doing with a tiger, right? Who put the tiger there? And they gave me a bowl to bleed in, and I bled all the way to the hospital in the back seat, into the emergency room. Once again, my mom works there. You know, she's fairly accustomed to this by now. It really doesn't even faze her having us come into the emergency room for various things. And anyway, but she's kind of upset. She's like, how much have you had to drink? And I'm like, two drinks, two beers, which, you know, is like in our DNA. If you're alcoholic, two is the magic number that you tell people, just two. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've said two. And the doctor came over and he asked me, you know, what happened? What's going on? And I said, I got bit by a dog. Because they had told me that I couldn't rat out the tiger. They'd take it away. It bit three other people. And, you know, it was like a, you know. So I didn't want to rat it out. I didn't want to rat him out. I knew better. Anyway, so they gave me all these rabies shots. And then animal control came, and they needed to find this dog, and so, you know, after they fixed me up and cast and bandaged and everything, I rode around for 3 days with animal control trying to find this damn dog, and it was nowhere to be found. We just couldn't find the dang thing. Anyway, so then, you know, football season was kind of blown for me, and that was like, I think, the first of my disappointing years. You know, I had played varsity the last couple years, and I was going to start every game on both sides. I was so excited. I love football. I live for football. And now I'm just a, you know, I have a cast. I have a club hand on my left hand. And so, you know, I still played. It was still fun, but it was kind of, drinking just became, took a bigger role in my life at that point. I began to drink, have a couple shots before practice, drink every night after the game. And I don't know, my parents had tried and tried and tried to get me to change and be different. And I mean, I was just so willful, and they were, you know, busy working. I had two younger sisters that were doing good at the time, and they were taking care of them. And they just kind of turned me loose. You know, I'd run away from home a few times. They had tried to take me to treatment one time, and I mean, it was just, I bolted. I was out of there. My fake ID had fallen out somewhere in that whole scuffle at the entrance of the treatment center. And fortunately, they'd mailed it back to me. They thought it was just a normal driver's license. But that's kind of, you know, what was going on. And that's why, I don't know, that's why I was able to drink every night, I guess. And so I got through that. I graduated from high school. And I started out, you know, with a lot of plans. And I, by the time I was done, I didn't have any plans at all, just to drink, other than drinking. And I got this warehouse job working at Ascot Distributors. They weren't making ascots, Randy, just so you know. It was tapes. And if you ever went to like a True Value hardware store back in the 80s or early 90s, I don't think they do it anymore. You see these cardboard boxes of, like, you know, Christmas displays of tapes. You know, Country Charlie Pride, Reba McEntire's Christmas, right? That was my version of I Have Arrived. putting those together and shipping them out, you know, and then smoking a lot of weed during the day because you couldn't drink at work, but you could smoke pot because one of the owners did. And I was just, you know, so high all day, every day. Too high, really. I wasn't ever a big drug addict. I didn't even smoke pot really towards the end of high school, but it just, you know, made me so hungry, and I'd fill my stomach up with chili cheese dogs and Doritos and just, you know, I have a propensity to eat anyway, and you throw a little weed on there and I'm gonna, but then I'm too full to drink, so I just really kind of avoided the stuff. But by the time I got off of work, every day I needed a drink, and my girlfriend, who I had adopted as my girlfriend and moved in with her because she had a lot of money and paid the rent when I was short, always had a half rack of Budweiser in the fridge when I got home. I mean, that is, if I wasn't such a bad alcoholic, that could still be happening today. Because that was not a bad deal. I mean, you know, I was using her and cared nothing for her, but I sure cared about the Budweiser, and it made me feel like I loved her. You know what I mean? And I love Budweiser. I love anything with alcohol in it. I'll be honest. I do. If it's got alcohol in it, I'll drink it. And that was my life, you know, and it was fun, and we're animals, and living in, you know how it was in Eugene, it's just, you know, country, hillbilly, go downtown, find a hippie, roll him, take his weed, you know, sell it or smoke it, go to the bar, fake IDs, get in a fight. I mean, I've been in more brawls, just giant melees, and it was just accepted, you know? I mean, I had this one night, I just couldn't even believe it. I was told this guy was a rapist. And, you know, I just, tell me that. That's all I need. Set me going. And I walked over there and hocked a big loogie right in his face. And it just, this thing, I mean, you never seen a party explode like this. I mean, there was, half the people got taken to the hospital. I mean, it was blood everywhere by the time we got done. And it was just me, right? I'm just out drinking, having fun with the guys. That's all. You know, you should have seen this place the next day. I mean, it was just trashed. And that happened time after time after time. And, you know, eventually I got fired from my job and, you know, homeless, no means to support myself. So I had this guy named Lance who lived in the neighborhood, and he is living with his ex-wife. And Lance was, how do you explain Lance? I mean, this guy was just like the meth head of meth heads. And we drank together once in a while, but I probably shouldn't use their names. These guys were like the worst criminals you've ever seen. But Raj, this other guy, was, you know, I guess had slept with Lance's ex-wife, which to me didn't seem like that big of a crime. But to Lance, it was a big deal. And so Lance had made this stick for Raj, which was a baseball bat with a bunch of nails sticking out of the end. And, but the problem for Lance was that he couldn't get his meth anymore from Raj. So that's where I come in. So I came over and he goes, try this, snort this. And I had never snorted anything before in my life. You know, other than snuff. We used to make these huge piles of snuff and see who could snort the biggest one. Just genius level IQ. I snorted that and I thought, holy smokes! That is an alcoholic's best friend. I mean, you could drink so much and go so fast and do so many things and talk to so many people and have so much fun for days and days and days and not sleep. It was awesome. Anyway, so I went over to Raj's house, and I mean, it was insane. This guy had every animal you could imagine in his house except a tiger, which was a policy that I had adopted. And it was sad almost, this situation was going on, but he had this like softball of dope. So anyway, that was where my drug dealing began, and it just started out with a simple transaction amongst mortal enemies, and continued from there. But so that was my kind of way I stayed out of being completely homeless for a while, and eventually I got busted, and that ran out, and I even fled the country for a while because I was afraid of prosecution, and lived in Jamaica for a little while, and came back to the States. It was a big deal. That was number two on my list of, like, poop storms. That was just, the kind of thing that almost gets you to think about not drinking, and then you'd have a second thought and realize, it wasn't that big of a deal. Come back and, do it. I gave up the dope dealing, but I was in and out of jail all the time. The cops had my number, and I couldn't drink and not fight. I couldn't drink and not, do things that were illegal. And, I never stole anybody's car. But if it's running, I just, I jump in and go. Just simple things. And then I got this dog. This girl gave me this dog. And she gave me a cat, too. And when I came back from Jamaica, the cat was just, like, ran out the front door. I mean, you don't feed a cat for a couple months or whatever. And, like, they don't like you anymore. It was gone. She bought me this dog, and still don't know what happened to that dog. But it would always get out and escape. And then I would get these tickets for dog at large. I mean, they're just really anal retentive in Eugene. And then I wouldn't go to court, and then I'd get a warrant for dog at large ticket, and I'd get thrown in jail for my dog. So the last time it happened, I was going to shoot that dog when I got out of jail. And I went over to my girlfriend's, she wasn't even my girlfriend anymore, she was living with one of her ex-boyfriends, but I went over to her grandfather's house and to get that dog and shoot it, and it was it had run away again. And I was like, that's it, dude. I'm not getting it. They can do what they want to do with that stupid dog. So I make amends to dogs now by not having one. Just so you know, I was a horrible pet owner. But treatment began to become an option. And I wouldn't go to treatment if the judge asked for it. I wouldn't do anything to have to do with any kind of recovery or Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous or nothing. They had me go to church for a while because I'd refused to do these things. I had to go see a therapist for a while. She made me lay down on a couch, play music, and think about these things that she was telling me while this music was playing on the couch. And I just, I'd get an erection. I mean, I didn't think about what, give me a moment of, silent meditation. And I never brought up the drinking. God, that's none of her business. Anyway, that didn't work, and it was a little embarrassing. She was older, but I was willing. I had standards, but anyway, I finally started thinking about treatment. That's where I was going with that. And my parents had long since changed the locks and didn't want anything to do with me. And so I went in my parents and my dad, and he, you know, really kind of last chance, last, you know, we'll help you. And I agreed, and I went there, and there was an intake counselor, and he was like one of those. I mean, he could have been a college professor by the way he looked, so, you know, I immediately didn't like him. And he was talking to me about how he went on vacation, and he would sit in a bar, and he would watch non-alcoholics drink. And he described how they would drink a drink or two drinks, or maybe not even finish the second one. And, you know, I just thought, my mom drinks like that, who cares? But why are you sitting there watching them? What is wrong with you? You're a disturbing idiot. No, I'm not going to your treatment. And I, you know, negotiated a deal where I just did outpatient. Well, I was serious about getting sober at this time. I mean, the heat was on, and I went to my first outpatient meeting, and I had a couple glasses of wine. And for me, that was really, really good. A whole day had went by, 5 o'clock in the evening, 2 glasses of wine. That's incredible for us, right? I mean, to do that, no job, nothing, just 2 glasses of wine. And they shunned me. They turned me away at the door. They said, "You've been drinking. You have to be sober." I said, "That's why I'm here. To learn how not to drink." I thought that was the point, and apparently it wasn't. So next week, I was blitzed. I came stumbling in there, and they checked me into detox, and I, you know, went to my first treatment center, which was phenomenal. Phenomenal. Right? Treatment? It's kind of the best, huh? You go in there. This place is Serenity Lane in Eugene, Oregon. It was amazing. I mean, you know, after the detox was over, that is, it was amazing. They had great food and 3 meals and a warm place and out of the rain and a comfortable bed and pretty girls. And I mean, we went to the YMCA every day and swam and sat in the hot tub. And I immediately got a girlfriend in there. And it was like, it was awesome. We went to group therapy and you just sit and talk about yourself. And oh, man, I love talking about myself. And then you'd get feedback, and oh man, you're really getting this thing, and you know. And then we'd go to the science side, and this is probably Howard probably knows what they're talking about. But I have too many oxide 2s in my platelets. Did I say that right? So kind of over my skill level at the time, but figured you'd be able to explain that one to me. And anyway, that's what makes me alcoholic. but this real pretty meth head wanted me to get her a bag when she got out, and I had given it up. You know, I didn't do that stuff anymore, but I was willing to get her a sack to get in the sack. No, just kidding. I got this job as soon as I got out, and I was serious about staying sober. I was really intent on staying sober, and I got this job doing construction, and I was going to my outpatient meetings and all that. And I'd go to my one AA meeting a week, and I really had a thing about AA, you know. It wasn't that I'd really judged so much as I just kind of knew that that's where you just people learn not to drink. And that really, I didn't like that plan at all. That the whole not drinking thing scared the crap out of me, so I avoided it. Went to one AA meeting a week, which was the counselor's minimum. Went to the outpatient meetings, and it was 2 weeks. I was crazy. I was nuts. I was beyond crazy. I was homicidal. I wasn't suicidal yet. I was homicidal. I was ready to, couldn't get along with my coworkers. Went home that night. You know, it was family night. 2 weeks of sobriety, or longer than that, but 2 weeks out of treatment, I was sober. Just 2 weeks. And they wanted my whole family to come in and talk about me in front of my treatment center co-graduates, which to me just sounded like the worst possible idea ever. To me today, it sounds like the worst possible idea ever. And they came in, and it was bad. It was a bad night. The whole thing was bad. I got nothing out of it other than I'm drinking when this is done. I'm drinking as soon as this is over, and that's the only thing that got me from walking out. And I got done, and I went home. But then I thought, I can't drink. I can't drink. I have warrants up the wazoo for my arrest. I'm just about this close to being homeless. I have no job. I have no life. I've destroyed everything good. I'm having these things that the doctor called, what do you call them, mini stroke. These things, this is the third thing that kind of instigated this treatment thing, was I was at this frat party, which I was never in a fraternity, but I love their parties. in Oregon State, at Oregon State University in Corvallis. And I was on this front porch, and I was just having the best night ever until all of my muscles just froze up and tightened, and my jaw clenched shut, and then I started vomiting through my teeth. And that sucked. I mean, that was bad. And I was telling my buddy Pat, I'm like, Pat, call 911. And, you know, it was like, I thought I was going to die for sure. And Pat, drunk, said, you should have thought about that before you, whatever. I can't remember what he said. But, I mean, he was like using this to tell me I shouldn't party so much, basically. And I was just, I was going to murder him if I lived. I seriously was going to kill this guy. So I went to the hospital. I got, you know, and this happened like three different times. And I just kind of blew it off and kept going and kept going and kept going. I almost choked to death. Anyway, back to that night. I thought about all these things, you know, and I thought about how I needed to not drink anymore. I needed to not party anymore. I needed to get a job. I needed to quit being the person that I had been up to that point. And I stayed sober that night. I didn't drink. I completely white-knuckled that night. Incredible that I was able to do that. But the weirdest thing happened is alcoholism, you know, I don't have a choice. I don't have a choice. And this is my first experience with not having a choice. And the big book says it. I didn't know it at the time. But I don't have a choice as to whether I'm going to drink or not. I'm going to drink again, period. I'm going to drink again unless I have a sufficient substitute. And I did. And it was the next morning, and it was just like it talks about and more about alcoholism. You know, about, you know, the guy who's going to have, first of all, you know, the guy goes into a bar because he's going to look for somebody to buy a car and he's hungry. You know, I'm sure there was a restaurant around, but no, he went to a bar to have a sandwich. And then he got some milk with his sandwich, but all that is just perfectly fine. And then he decided to have another sandwich. Now, here's where the story gets weird in the big book. Okay, have you ever gone and, like, say, got a hamburger? And then, like, ate it and then just thought, I could use another hamburger. You know? I mean, that has, I don't think that's ever happened to me. And I have done my share of overeating, I assure you. And then he gets another, you know, glass of milk. And then he's like, you know, two hamburgers, two glasses of milk, throw a shot of whiskey in there. This ain't going to hurt me, you know, on a full stomach or whatever with milk. I mean, that is insane thinking, right? At least for me, it was, you know, I'll have a no duels. It tastes like beer. It goes down smooth, whatever, you know, just something. But that's what happened, is there was no thought. And then it goes on to say, I was something about, I sensed, geez, I used to have this quote on the tip of my tongue. I would if this was a night meeting. This is a morning meeting. I vaguely sense I was being none too smart. That's what it was. I vaguely sense I was being none too smart. You know, right? And that's what, you know, the next morning, that was it. I was walking to Dairy Mart. They have a liquor store. At 6 a.m., there wasn't a single thought that crossed my head. There was like, that was more of a feeling than a thought that I vaguely sensed. I was being none too smart. And I got a 40 of Pabst Blue Ribbon. Because it was like $1.25. And that's all the change I could scrounge, was $1.25. And I drank that 40. And that just basically was, you know, what I needed. And I was off and running. And I, you know, I'd given up all my dope dealing. I had given up the stuff. I told everybody that I was going to rat them out. Said, I'm done dope dealing. I'm gonna. If you talk to me, get near me, bring that stuff, I'm going to the cops. You're all going down. Every last one of you. I'm going to the top. You know. And I mean, I had Hell's Angels, Mexican Mafia. I had all these people, you know. And I just told them. I said, I'm done. And they were glad. They were done with me. They were sick of my crap because they knew how I was. You know, I mean, where I go, cops go. Period. It doesn't matter. That there just seems like no matter what, and it's just innocent me drinking, but, you know, it's like I just have these, like, brownouts where I'm, like, pulling the bartender over the bar for not serving me and stuff like that, and then, you know, someone calls the police every time. I don't know why that's a big deal. I still don't know why. I mean, if you're a bartender, you should be able to handle that kind of stuff, but Anyway, where was the heck was I going with that? Oh yeah, I drank that next and I was off. And anyway, this is the last thing, is I became homeless, just completely homeless. I was done. No family, no druggies, no ex-friends, nobody would let me stay on their couch. It was one, you know, it was kind of what I needed to really hit bottom. And I lived in a shed, and I lived, you know, just wherever I could live and just kind of scrounge my way along for about, I don't even know how long it was. I really don't. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I have such, somebody else would probably tell my story better than me. I don't remember very much that happened to me. I just remember that I was homeless. And I remember it was in the winter, and it was wet, and it was cold, and it was rainy. And then I'm not, you know, I already knew I wasn't a jail guy, and now I know I'm not a homeless guy. But so where do I fit? And it got to the point where I was just crazy, just nuts. And I, you know, I would go do these jobs for people. Every now and then somebody would come find me to go do a job. And I'd either go paint or go steal a car for somebody that someone had stolen from them or whatever, you know. I was just kind of in this seedy Eugene underworld, you know, that I was involved in. And it just kind of got me by. And eventually that ran out. And I went back to this treatment center again as all I knew to do. I didn't know where else to go, where else to turn. And I went there and talked to this guy. And he said, you know, here's what you need. He goes, you've been here 3 or 4 times. You can't stay sober. You need to go to Alaska. You need to go to this place. Let me go get this. And he goes and he finds this flyer. And it's this beautiful place with green fields and horses. And he's like, you need to go here, you know. You can't drink here. You're locked away in the wilderness. 10 feet of snow, wolves, bears. You can't get to alcohol. This is what you need. And I thought, you know, and then I don't know what it was about. The whole thing about, he said, and then they have these Christmas shows, and you can all sing and be in a play together. And I don't, for some reason, that sounded nice to me, and I don't know what that was all about. But you know, I've never really been that guy, but it's that for some reason, there's something about that that kind of drew me in and sold me on the deal. So I went, decided to come to Alaska, and I, you know, it was rough. It was rough. I hit the airport in Seattle, and I got just blitzed, hammered drunk. And I had been pretty much drunk around the clock, having all these problems. I had completely lost feeling in my hands. My nervous system was shutting down, which I think had something to do with those mini strokes or whatever. I just couldn't feel stuff, and every now and then I'd get like a tingling sensation in my hands. And, you know, I knew it wasn't good. Something about my health was wrong. And I got in the airplane, I flew to Alaska, and the Nugent's Ranch bus picked me up there, and I just, you know, tumbled in, and I didn't really, I kind of, you know, there was people in there, and it just didn't, I kind of got the sense that it wasn't what I thought it was going to be like, and they drove me out an hour, and I got to this place, and I didn't notice it right away, but they got me into detox, and, you know, it felt like there was something wrong, and I had my Marlboros, and I went outside to smoke a cigarette, and it was like the wind was blowing like 50 miles an hour. There's no trees to stop it. It was just like, I immediately felt like I got frostbite everywhere. I had no warm clothes. I'd been homeless. I ran back inside, you know, and then I'd run back out and try to smoke and run back in. I mean, it was like I was just, those 3 days were crazy. And then they took me downstairs the next morning, and I got down there, and I went into this room, and I walked in through this door into this room, and everyone was sitting around in a circle with a hat on that was covered in flowers and fruit. And I just thought, Jesus, I am hallucinating. And I had done just a ton of LSD. I mean, I had done so much LSD that I'll never be in any government for anything ever. And so I just knew that was it. I was having a flashback, you know, but it turned out it was Easter, and it was Easter bonnet day at Nugent's Ranch. And anyway, it kind of made me feel a little better that it was a holiday. I had breakfast and it was just tough times. And I, kind of got through that, and they told me to get a sponsor, and it was different in the sense that there was this sort of united effort in Wasilla, Alaska, between the counselors and between the people in AA that were coming in there. It was like everybody was talking about this sponsor thing. And I hadn't heard much about sponsorship back in Eugene. It was, you know, I'd heard a lot of stuff about how, you know, this one guy, and I always share this because I just think it's amusing, but he said that he got his bachelor's degree, and as soon as he got his bachelor's degree, because he got it in sobriety, he was going to drink, and that was like his goal. And he got it, but he wanted to stay sober, so he quickly decided to get his master's degree. And then he got his master's degree, and he was going to drink, but then he decided he wanted to stay sober, so he went and got his doctorate. And he was almost going to graduate, and then he was going to drink, or whatever, after that happened. And I just, he lost me at bachelor's degree, you know, I just, like, whatever, this AA is stupid. It sounded to me like pure misery. It sounded to me like a lot of people, and this other guy would share, and he was so angry. And he was an alcoholic meth addict, and he would rant and rave. He was one of those guys, his arms were flying everywhere, and he'd yell and scream, and I just thought, this guy is not serene. You know, he's not saying the serenity prayer or whatever. You know, and then and I'd be, most of the time, I'd be, you know, had drank in a few O'Doul's before the meeting or whatever anyway, so I don't, you know, I'm sure there was a good message in there somewhere, but that's what I remember. In Wasilla, it was this united front, and this tall, bald guy named Brad would come in there, and you know how you're a newcomer, and you remember what it's like when I was scared to death. I didn't know I was scared. What it felt like was threat assessment. I don't remember you ever saying that before. But that's what it was, you know. It was threat assessment, you know. It was, first of all, I needed to shore up the lady situation. Then I had to find out who the threats were. Then I had to find out who the fighters were. And then I had, you know, all that stuff going on as soon as I got to treatment. But what it did was it just made me hyper aware of myself, hyper self-conscious, hyper self, not able to relate, not able to relax, always too tough or try to be witty or try to be funny or anything but just be me and relax. And this guy would come in here, and he would laugh and joke and slap people on the back like he didn't have a care in the world. And that was so attractive to me because I just knew that I did. I couldn't really identify exactly what it was. And consequently, as long as I'm talking about Bob, I got a lot of my stuff from Bob. I listened to him all the time, and I knew him. I've known him ever since I got sober almost seeing him at conferences. And there was this talk that I gave at the Alano Club. No, it was at the Dry Dock when I was like 2 years sober. And it was all Bob. And it was good. It was good. I mean, I blew that crowd away. And they came up to me afterwards, and they're like, you should run for office. And I was 2 years sober, and I'm like, it was the best talk I'll never give that good of a talk again. I hit my peak at 2 years sober, you know. But then I didn't see Bob for a few years. And then he came up, the inner group brought him up for this like all-day step study or whatever. And it was really cool. But I noticed that he was stealing some of my material when he was sharing. And kind of disturbed me a little bit. I just wanted to say that, you know. I'm still kind of upset about that. You know, I repeated crap so long I thought it was all mine. And there's nothing that's all mine except for the really dumb parts of my story. There's nothing new that you're going to hear here, that's for sure. But anyway, so there was this guy, and he was just on it, you know. And I didn't want to ask anyone to be my sponsor. I just didn't want to go through that. But I was kind of forced into it. You know, I'd get to that. He'd take a van full of guys to the meeting, and they would attack me. They would all come up. They would circle around me. There was Jimmy Fenster and Kurt Burrows and Ron Clemens and Robert and a few other people and Brad. And they were, you know, you need a sponsor. You don't got a sponsor? What are you doing? Are you serious about staying sober? You need, what, you are? Well, you need to get a sponsor then, act like it, blah, 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 you know. And I was kind of offended on the one hand, and on the other hand, it was nice to have the attention, and it was also nice to have everybody on the same page. They were all saying the same thing, and pretty much the message was, you know, rammed home, and I got a sponsor eventually. I got Brad, and he said two things to me. He said, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? Was the first question, and I said, yes, I was. That 50-degree wind, the thought of being homeless, 50-degree wind, 50-mile-an-hour wind, 0 degrees on a warm day in Wasilla back then. I mean, it was a cold, cold winter. Yes, willing to go to any length to stay sober. Any length. Whatever I got to do, short of, never mind, I will do to stay sober. And maybe even that. No, just kidding. And then he said something that pissed me off. He said, okay, well, here's the other thing. When it comes to your life, my thinking is better than your thinking. Do you understand that? And I paused for a minute, you know, and then I lied and said yes. But it kind of made me mad, you know, because no one's thinking is better than my thinking. My thinking is world class. My thinking, I mean, it's just, I just know things about everyone there is to know. I know everything I need to know about you in 5 minutes. I've always prided myself on that, you know? Just a mountain of pride about my abilities to know things. And so I knew that was BS, but I said yes anyway. And then we began to work steps. And this guy was, he was really severe, I thought. I mean, for one thing, he had me call him every morning at 6:15. 6:25. Every morning. I had to get up anyway at 6, which most of the time I didn't, and then this old guy would come around and kick my bed and make me get out of bed, and I'd have to get out of bed at this work farm that I was at. Call him up. I had nothing to say. I didn't want to be conversational at that hour of the day. I didn't want to, you know, but he would just say everything, and I would just say yes or no answers, and then we'd hang up the phone, and then we'd go about our business and go through the day, and then he'd come pick me up. And if he was always on time, but if I was 5 minutes late, I'd see nothing but taillights. He'd be gone. He didn't have to say a lot about that. I kind of figured it out, you know. We kind of just started being there ready to go, and he'd take me to the meeting, and we'd go to the meeting and get to the meeting, and I'd sit in the back, and then he'd make me sit in the front. And it was kind of like this. I'd be in the back. It was only 3 rows and about 9 people, but it felt like I was all the way back there in my head, my disease of perception. And he'd say, "Hey, drool boy." Okay? Now imagine, if you will, I'll use Ross as an example because he was late. I haven't got a good nickname for Ross yet, but anyway. Ross, newcomer puke, here's your seat, while he's sitting back there amongst all his buddies. And we have to be tough. We can't let anybody do that. I mean, you know, that's, don't disrespect me. You do not disrespect this homeless pig farmer. You will feel the heat. It just doesn't happen. But then I'd remember that 50-mile-an-hour wind and those temperatures outside, and I would do the, you know, 3-row walk of shame to the front and sit down as I was told. And then during the meeting, I would talk a lot. I just, you know, I had a lot to say, a lot to offer, and I felt. And Brad and Ron, you know, they were like the two pillars of Alcoholics Anonymous, sitting in the two front right there, and they'd both look at me at the same time usually and say, "Shh." Faces would all just, they'd do demons, you know, just, and I just bristle with antagonism, you know. I just want to murder them both right in their seats. I'd think all these thoughts about, and I'd forget about that, and I'd go back into my two feelings that I had at the time. And it was hate and lust. Those were the two ones I could summon at any given moment. They were interchangeable, back and forth. I could hate and lust at the same time. I mean, I had skills. There was only one girl in the meeting to lust after, and she was gone shortly thereafter, and it was all dudes, and it was just hate. You know, that's all I was left with. It was just hate. And I go back to the treatment, and there was no, you know, there was no girlfriend there or anything, you know. It was just like God was just working me over, you know. There was the only cute girl was a lesbian at the pig farm, and you know, they were all older than me. They were all homeless. They were all, you know, they were all just like me. I was just, you know, I was 23 or whatever. And anyway, that quickly became not a big deal. You know, you work with what you got. But Somehow I made it without having a girlfriend. I say, let me just throw that out there. I made it through treatment without having a girlfriend. You know, but we would work through the steps, and we did all of them. It was great. You know, he took me through them, and each one seemed a ridiculous, insurmountable hurdle. The four step, the, and I, you know, and I hate speakers that go through the steps because I just, you know, I just. So I won't. So I'll start with one. I'm just kidding. And he was a really great sponsor, you know. But something happened when I was about 9 or 10 months sober. I was out at the treatment center, and I was kind of coming to my own a little bit, you know. I got this job making $6.50 an hour at MAPCO, working the night shift. I had arrived again, you know. I felt like I was somebody, and I was at the meeting, and my sponsor, I was such an arrogant little puke, Lord Almighty. But my sponsor was sharing that night, and I was timing him, and I wasn't the timer. But he went for like 8 minutes, and everybody else went for 4 or 5 minutes. So after the meeting, I figured it was my job and duty to talk to him about it, and I pulled him over to the side, and Brad, I said, listen, everybody else, you know, 4 or 5 minutes, but you, you know, you, I know you didn't know this, but you went 8. And just bring it to your attention, you know, so you understand. And he knew this wasn't going to be good, so he brought me in the back room, and he said, listen. He goes, how long have you been sober? And I said, 9 months. And he said, how long have I been sober? And I said, 9 years. And he said, don't you think I know a little more about staying sober than you do? And I could do the math. I mean, I was pretty quick at math always. And I said, yeah. And he said, you know, you go, he said, where do you live? And I, where, you know, I told him I live at a halfway house now. And he, where do you live before that? He said, I said, I lived at the pig farm. And, you know, how many roommates did you have? Or in your room, in your actual room? Like, you know, I said, there's 4 guys in there. And okay, great. You live at a halfway house. You had 4 guys in your room with the pig farm. What about before that? He goes, I was homeless. He goes, well, look, man, you managed your life so hard and so good that you wound up at a pig farm. That was the best you could do, you know, with 4 other homeless dudes living there, them telling you when to eat, when to get up, when to shower, when to shave, when to clean, when to scrub the pig pens, when to clean the chicken. That was the best you could do with your management of your life. That was as good as it got. And now you come into Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't, you know, obviously you don't respect me. You don't respect anybody. You don't respect yourself. Here's what you need to do. You need, and I could, and I was kind of nodding because I was going, I was kind of getting the gist of what he was saying. Like, it sort of dawned on me at 9 months sober that I can't manage my own life. And it hadn't dawned on me before that. When you're in a treatment center, you don't really understand the steps to the full, you know. And if you're new here, you know, I'm not saying you haven't worked steps or had a spiritual experience of some kind. I'm just saying when you're not in treatment anymore, life hits you right in the face. And you almost have to go through the steps again because everything's real. I mean, you got to work and pay your rent. You got to go. Your spiritual life counts. Your spiritual life is going to make the decision of whether or not you go to the meeting that night. And everything just becomes so much more real and uncomfortable. And he said that to me, and I just, you know, I was kind of understanding that I had not really worked the first step to the extent that the big book requires. And he said, you know, you haven't been able to manage your life. And he said, and he went on about this respect thing, and he said, you need to respect one person, and that person is your sponsor. I don't care if you do or not. He didn't care. It was never a big deal for him, you know, if I got him a cup of coffee or, you know, showed him a little deference or respect. It was for me. And it was like the most powerful thing that happened to me in early sobriety was to, that one person, because I had no respect for myself. I just knew I was a loser. I knew I was just a piece of crap. I was a user and a taker, and I had a million amends to make, and I'd caused all this grief and problems in my life. And he told me that I needed to start there, and if I started there, I'd begin to sooner or later respect myself. And then he added on the old-timers, and then he added on the other people in the rooms. Then he added on the newcomers over time, and slowly but surely, I begin to have that thing called self-esteem, and I begin to build that thing called respect. And it all started with sponsorship. It all started with having that one person in my life, you know. And I slip back into being a smart aleck sometimes, trying really hard not to swear. And that doesn't sound good, smart aleck. But I just slip into it sometimes, but it doesn't matter for him, but it's not good for me. I need to continue to have that one person in my life, because without that, I begin to lose it. And I have, a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And for me, I need to show respect. I need to be respectful. It's something that I can give back to the world. It's something that I can do. And so he reminds me of that from time to time. Because my natural state is that, the kid on the street. And it seems like it's, I know it's not, but sometimes it seems like it's only skin deep. You get me away from meetings long enough and all that stuff starts creeping back into my life. But I had a home group. I had a bunch of guys who were doing the same thing. They were all on the same page. They were serious about the solution. They did not let me share the problem unless it was immediately followed up by the solution. I had to have a commitment at the meeting. I had to have a commitment at all the meetings that I went to. He told me that I could not get a job that made me miss my meetings. And this was radical for me, because up here in Alaska we get slope opportunities and work on the peninsula and go here and go there and all these things, and I've not seen a high percentage number of people doing that in AA and be successful. Every now and then you get one or two that make it work, but he said, I'm probably not in that success factor area of those. I'm not the one, basically. That I am an alcoholic. That I am, just about ready to go off the rails at any given day. And that I need a steady, strong diet of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's kind of amazing. There's a spiritual thing that happens when you make a surrender in AA. And it doesn't matter what the surrender is. And it doesn't matter how you feel about it. It doesn't matter if I disagree with every fiber of my being, which I did, something happens. And I worked that MAPCO job, gas station night attendant, armor-alling the pumps, sweeping the sidewalks, occasionally having bouts of stomach problems from the wings at the windbreak, and I'd have to go in the bathroom, and then people would have to leave money on the counter when they got there. But, other than that, it was pretty good. And it was humbling. It was humbling. And then my next job was, I worked at the school as a safety officer. Security guard? I mean, does it get any worse than that? Sponse? I mean, this is the worst. I've hit bottom now in sobriety. I've not arrived, I've hit bottom. And then I got a property management job on the side, and they gave me a free apartment with this other guy, and, It was mayhem. I mean, we were just newcomers, and it was fun. It was exciting, And then I got this other roommate who had seizures all the time. I mean, this guy was just looped, and he was Ron Sponsey. His name was Mark. And then I had this other guy that I sponsored named Andy. And they were sitting in a meeting one time together, and Andy was sitting behind Mark, and Mark was flicking this girl some crap sitting next to him, and Andy started getting mad about that, and he started flicking his ear really hard from behind. Well, Mark turned around with his leather punch on his Swiss Army knife and stabbed Andy in the knee. We told him to knock it off, and we'd continue with the meeting. It was fine. We just went, we rolled right on through it. That's what it was like. And then we had this old guy who's now passed away named Gary, and he'd fly off the handle all the time and wanted to fight everybody, and he was angry. We'd always had these people come through. And then you get these knuckleheads that would come into this meeting just to wear a hat. I mean, come on. I mean, how ridiculous is that? Because we're a meeting that said, please take your hat off. Well, there's 40 other meetings in the valley you can wear a hat, but they wanted to come into this meeting so they could wear a hat. Just to be defiant. I mean, you want to be a four-year-old, be a four-year-old, I mean, that is just the stupidest thing I ever saw. And I was a four-year-old, and I could see that. So how stupid are they, And my sponsor was just so good about it, I couldn't believe it. He just said politely, please take your hat off or whatever, He didn't make a big fuss about it. And I was irate. I mean, because it was like they were personally stepping on my territory. And I was a gang member who listened to Eazy-E in eighth grade, They don't know who they're messing with. But anyway, I'd get all bent out of shape about stuff, and my sponsor would just be like, you just do what you can, whatever. But he is a spiritual giant with a high level of integrity, and that's who I needed in my life. I needed somebody to aspire to. that I could look up to, that I could grow towards. You know, if he was watching pornography all the time and, you know, scamming chicks and, you know, doing all this other crap in AA, I'd be doing the same thing and a lot more, because that's about as good as I am. I'm as good as the next guy in front of me, but a little bit worse. And I find that with the guys I sponsor, you know. It's like I gotta live up to a certain point, because they're not gonna do more than me. I don't know what spiritual rule that is in life, but I've never seen them do more than me. You know what I mean? It's like they'll do. Sponsor isn't really doing that, so I'm not going to either. You know, and I'm the same way. So that keeps me active and in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And speaking of porn, I'll bring this up just because it's fun. You know, I was had a little problem when I was new, and it was the VHS thing. You know, you throw that in there and. And then I'd feel guilty about it because I told my sponsor and he told me not to do it anymore. So I'd go throw it in the dumpster, and then I'd go to work and go to the meeting. And then it wasn't garbage day yet, so I'd run out there and snag that son of a gun. And Spiritual giant. It's been a long road, people. It's been a long path, you know. My VCR was worn out. No, I'm just kidding. I stopped doing that for the most part, you know. I pretty much kicked that habit, but every now and then, you know, something twinkle in my eye. My beautiful wife is looking at me like I'm an idiot right now and shaking her head. With this, you know, I need to talk about that because that's big. I had this girl that I, you know, was dating. And she worked in this office, but there was this other girl in this office that I wanted to trade her in for. But I just couldn't do it, you know, at the time, because the girl was only 18. And anyway, years later, she wasn't 18 anymore. And she happened to be single one day, and so was I. And what do you know? Started texting. And it was, I mean, I wore like two phones out. Because, you know, you date younger girls that are, you know, 8, 9, 10 years younger than you, and they just text. So I learned how to text. Thank you, Shannon, for teaching me that. But that's how I got her, was through text. And anyway, I had been just crushing on this girl for 9 years. I would get these super hot assistants to work for me. And then I'd parade him in front of her office to try to make her jealous. And I'd also just show them that, you know, look at this girl. She's so hot. And they'd agree, you know. And anyway, so one day I was able to make it happen. I'd locked it down. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous, newcomers. That's what you get. You got to stay in the middle. You got to call a sponsor and do what he says. And you get the girl. Okay? It's all the hope I got for you today, brothers. But if you're new, I want you to get a sponsor. I want you to call that sponsor. That's what I did. I want you to listen to him. You know, even if he's got job advice or marital advice, you know, he's not doing it for him. If he wants you to get him a cup of coffee, he's not doing it for him. He's doing it for you. And thank God. Now, today, I find myself very willing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope I can stay that way. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.